Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, it's Maria van Boekelen and Marco Verhey. We Are Change Rotterdam, reporting on Secret Rulers of the World, the Bilderberg Conference over in Turin, Italy, a couple of weeks ago. Silicon Valley people there, Google, etc. What are they up to? Also, Chris Wilson. He's been over to Peru to sample a hallucinogenic drug called ayahuasca. Various celebrities have had this. Sting, David Icke, Paul Simon, the singer Tori Amos, and the model Lindsay Lohan. So how did he get on? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. It's Marco Verhey and Maria van Boekelen from We Are Change Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and they've both been at the Bilderberg Conference. And I suppose the first question to ask you both is, what is the Bilderberg Conference?
What is the Bilderberg? Well, that's a really good question, I think. I think everybody should wonder what the Bilderberg really is. We made a documentary about what happens at Bilderberg, but even what is Bilderberg is even a better question. I think it's a bit network thing where people get together that are higher up in the elites, and they get to know people that are a bit lower, and some of them will get up into this elite and some won't. So I think it's a big network thing.
It's also a Dutch word, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it is and it isn't. I think it stems from German. That's why I think it is originally from. But, of course, the hotel in Oosterbeek is where it's named from, the Bilderberg Hotel. Even though I have to tell you that after 1954, there's different hotels in the Netherlands that were acquired by the Bilderberg Hotel Group, I need to say. And so here in Rotterdam is also a Bilderberg Hotel.
So if you're searching online for Bilderberg, you won't necessarily find these conferences. You might find a nice swanky joint. But anyway, Maria, what do you think Bilderberg is?
I 100% agree with Marco. So I couldn't tell my bits. So, and it's true. When you Google Bilderberg or find another search machine, then you will find lots of nice locations for a holiday. But unfortunately, in Turin, the Bilderberg location was not that nice as it used to be. So it was a kind of crappy atmosphere in the Fiat factory. But I think we will talk about that later.
Okay, what about the annual agenda? These guys meet up once a year. They're really from the NATO countries, and I think that's important to stress. People say that this is the rulers of the world or something. They're really more, if anything, only the rulers of the NATO world, but they are very much associated with the NATO countries and also with NATO itself because of the arms lobby. There's a lot of arms companies there. There's people like Petraeus, who was the American commander-in-chief of Iraq, the invasion of Iraq, this kind of thing. So there's a military bent to it, but maybe Marco, you can start by taking us through some of the items on the agenda this year. What was actually being discussed? Assuming we can trust the Bilderbergs to tell us what's really going on in there.
Yeah, I do have to give you a big compliment, Tony, on the way you explained the whole Bilderberg agenda. You put behind brackets, you put what it really means.
Yes.
No, I was really struck by that. Well, that was really good. Yeah. For me, the number one populism in Europe is, the most interesting one, although all the other ones are interesting as well. But to me personally, the number one populism in Europe.
So what do you think that they were talking about in there? And what is populism in Europe?
Yeah, well, populism. You might think that all politicians are populists, but this is not the case. Some people are called populists because, well, the elite doesn't like them, and they are supposed to be saying and doing what the people like. Bilderbergers don't like that.
Why not?
Because they have a different agenda. They want different things than what the general public wants.
Okay, so look, let's imagine we've got a Bilderberger and a member of the general public sitting around a table. What is the difference about the way they see the world and the way they want the world to go?
Well, a Bilderberger is internationally oriented, so he will look at the whole world and he will try to get his advantage from the whole world, so he's not really rooted in any one country. You can also see that with our royalty, of course. They are from different countries in Europe, but they don't have really any Dutch DNA. And that is what most of these real Bilderbergers are, not people that are attached to their own countries.
Okay, so what about you, Maria? What sticks in your mind about the agenda this year? Which do you think is the most interesting topic they're talking about?
Yeah, from my point of view, that is everything that involves AI, 5G, or the development of the smart control grids that we're facing. So they talked about the future of work, which definitely will go on about AI. There was a big research paper done by KPMG, and it was all about the effects of AI on the workforce, and that is stunning, you know, that is big, that is major. So they have to talk about the future of work, obviously.
Then so, sorry to interrupt you, but how do we know if we're talking to a real person or a computer nowadays?
Yeah, you can't, unfortunately. It will be very difficult to make sure that, on the other hand, like right now, there is a real person. And I think they did, from their perspective, a splendid job. They did the Turing test and they took it to several chatbots. And it was believable difficult, so hardly impossible to make sure that the person which is talking to you, to make sure that it's a human person.
Good God. I mean, so what you're saying is somebody who you're talking to in either an internet chat room or maybe on Twitter could just be artificial intelligence computer.
Exactly. And that's one of the well, it's something that I love to hate, or I hate to love, but still, you can also see there is a new technology. And this all that you can talk in your head, I'm not kidding you around, silently talk in your head, and then we are connected with another person that has this specific tool, put it on his head. It's now still quite big, but that's only a matter of time. So we're entering an age that we don't know exactly if the person that we're talking to is really a person. And that's possible to have a sort of telepathy in between persons, so you don't know if people are speaking with them when you are sitting with them in the room. So you could imagine what that would mean in terms of a justice, people that get picked up by the police, etc. So we're really entering a sort of twilight zone.
I mean, it sounds to me like science fiction, this. And the other problem with that kind of telepathy system is what happens when you're able to read someone else's thoughts and they don't know.
Exactly. So the only thing that you more or less have to do is make sure that they are at the same wavelength, so to speak. So they're a little bit hush-hush about this kind of possibilities, because they now only are looking at a way that people give their consent. But on the other hand, you know, these developments are going incredible fast. And what we see is most of the time things that are, you know, that an awareness that everybody may know what has happened. So it's gone public then right now. That was the word that I'm looking. So what we see that is public is probably out of the pilot phase and pushed in regular usage. So that's one thing that you have to keep in mind. So that's all about artificial intelligence. Then you have in the same week, you have this quantum computing. Well, quantum computing is a term that I don't think that most Bilderbergers knows a lot about. It's quite difficult to understand. So I'm really in doubt why as well artificial intelligence as quantum computing is on the list. But I have to admit, when you see the lineup, we see Jared Cohen over there, we see Alex Karp, we see Hassabis. These are all people from very powerful companies like DeepMind, like Google, and what's the last?
Palantir?
Yeah, Palantir, thank you.
Yeah, so this, let's have a little chat about these technologies, though, because I've been having a look at Palantir and their various systems. One of them is called Gotham, which I imagine is modelled on Gotham City in Batman. And the idea is that they're trying to sell this technology to our politicians, to our civil servants, and saying, well, using this technology, you can completely understand and look into and drill down into your entire population. So, for example, if you wanted to know where the Muslims are in your country, if you wanted to know where the rich people are, if you wanted to know where the people who use bicycles are, if you wanted to know where the people who shop at a particular supermarket are in your country, you can have a map using this Palantir technology of everybody and where they are, and you can understand. I mean, this is what they're doing, is they're selling this to our politicians, saying here's the best way to understand who your voters and your your population are.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think with the rollout of 5G that is going quite smooth and swiftly in Europe, they have more or less set up a sort of control grid, because 5G, probably you know this, needs a very tight network. You know, the frequency makes it possible to have real-time data exchange. And that's not only about pictures, so it's not only about facial recognition, but it's also about noise, it's also about sounds. So you can do anything with this. So it's not only about receiving the information, it's also about sending information or frequencies.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because we think of these, I mean, we've got a lot of government money behind smart meters here in Britain.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're pushing these things into our houses, even though the people don't want them. Now, the idea that there is that, you know, you can have a smart meter, which you can access. The fact of the matter is, though, that also the electricity, the gas companies, they can access these things and they can switch it off. The other thing is that if it's hacked, somebody from China, America, the NSA, GCHQ, whoever can hack in and switch off your power. So these things are a bit of a cursed technology. They call it the Internet of Things. What do you make of this smart technology?
Oh, yeah. Well, we made a documentary about the subject. I have to tell you, maybe you've heard, it's called Digitropolis.
Digitopolis. Okay.
Digitropolis. It's an hour-long documentary about health, about the effects on your daily routine, about how is power developed. And
well, obviously, that's a bit difficult for people to watch in Dutch, but can you just
No, it's not in Dutch. It's subtitles, in English, in
German. Oh, it's subtitles. Fantastic.
Spanish. So, but the most important thing about this is that, and that is something I want to outline or underline, is that the way that we don't think about what is happening right now under our nose. So, for an example, for the smart meters, you have this activist group called Empower. I think people need to check this out, because they are doing a very great job. But the other thing is that all these little 5G boxes that we'll put on our Latin poles, they will actually have the possibility to create a sort of active denial system. The same system that is used in Iraq by defense. So you can imagine if they can...
Hang on,
turn.
This is the lampposts, and you've got boxes on top of the lampposts. And if they're configured in a certain way, it will emit such a concentration of microwaves that it actually starts to burn your skin and you have to run away.
Exactly. There are, I'm not saying that they will do that, but that they will be able to do this. And I think that's scary enough.
Wow, that's pretty scary. Anyway, look, why don't we go through the participant list at Bilderberg a little bit, and maybe each of you can tell us about somebody that you found as a particularly interesting person at this conference? And yeah, let's bear in mind that this a lot of this technology is secret. It's developed by companies who want to keep patents and copyrights. It's also often developed by the military, and it's sold to the military. The Palantir technology, for example, has just been, there's just been some kind of contract with the US military and some other contract with the British Home Office, that is to say the government. And yet, contracts are being signed, and yet the people don't even know what's going on. But anyhow, Maria, what about your favourite participant?
Well, my favourite participant is definitely Jared Cohen. This guy is really amazing. He's now the head of Jigsaw. And Jigsaw is a part of Google. Before, it was well known as Google Ideas. And this guy is really something different. I think he was 24 years old. He already worked with Condoleezza Rice. Then he worked with Hillary Clinton. He was well known as the person who was twittering when Iran burned. And then he was a special advisory of advisor of Richard Holbrooke. And he wrote a bestseller a book with Eric Schmidt from Google. And he really introduced Jared Cohen as a sort of, well, how you could say it, our new savior. So this guy is very well known in politics on a very high level. And he is very smart and now head of one of the most powerful tech companies in the world. So, well, that gives you quite an idea why this guy is so incredibly important for now, and I think for the next couple of 10 years.
Amazing, isn't it, that you know these are very powerful people, and yet we hardly see anything much of them on our mainstream press. One of the things that this does put me in mind of is this whole kind of transhumanist agenda, where you've got the dreams of the super rich, because I mean these are the sorts of people who, you know, they have money, they've bought everything they possibly can with the money they've got, the billions of dollars that they, you know, in control of. They can buy, you know, multiple houses, they can buy themselves their own private jet, they can buy a nice you know, kind of luxury yacht, whatever it is. But once they've got all those things,
they want more, Tony, don't you understand? They always want more.
It's never enough.
No.
And that's why I bring up transhumanism, because there are some people out there, I mean, whether they're right or wrong, I have no idea, but they're selling this idea that, you know, you can actually go beyond being a human. That is to say...
And they are doing it right now.
What they're saying is, I mean, I think it's Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of engineering at Google, because Google feature very big at this year's Bilderberg, is when somebody asked him, they said, do you think God exists? Ray Kurzweil says, well, no, but he will soon.
Oh, yeah. But Ray Kurzweil is a very special person. He's also one of the major figures in our documentary, because he's a visionary, you know. I think he's in this business for ages, I think over 30 years. And he has this very strong idea that he wants to make a step up, a new evolution, the humanoids 2.0, as he calls it. And... yeah, it's not about digital revolution. It's all about a human evolution. And Ray Kurzweil want to be the person that supports this, that makes this possible.
But is this a utopia or is it a dystopia?
No, it's not a utopia. And I think Ray Kurzweil mentioned that 2028 will be the moment that we will be humanoids. And he makes a very strong case about this, and I think it's feasible. And if you look at other related designs like Neuralace and Neuralink, that is now more or less owned by Elon Musk, you have to admit it will be quite simple and a matter of time before we will be able to have our personal experience like you're looking at a movie right now, or you can learn a language in, well, an hour or two. So it's really entering the matrix in a way that we never thought of. We always thought of a fear for chips or something in our body. That's not really the point anymore. We went way beyond this whole concept. And we're looking to a new evolution. That's the point. That's one of the major topics, I think, that we as journalists are now trying to understand and trying
But Maria, surely, I mean, I'm sure if Ray was here, he'd say, look, this could be a wonderful utopia.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I think, and I have to admit, a lot of developments that comes from and inventions that comes from AI are marvelous, and I love them all. So it's not about what they develop, it's how you use this technique. And I think there is no ethical restrictions, no law, no common sense about that we really need to think about what can happen in the worst case scenario. But everyone is driven by money. Everyone wants to, you know, get a piece of the pie, and they want to be the first one because there's a lot at stake right now. So, yeah, we're looking at a very interesting time, and I think it will all kick off by the implementing of 5G, because that is the infrastructure that AI needs to really develop more quicker than it does right now.
Well, I know. I wonder how we can defend against it if we don't necessarily want the internet and all this technology going through our homes. And I wonder if you decide that you don't want this in your home, whether you're suddenly going to start getting a kind of prickling sensation on your skin, you know, due to your local AI-controlled 5G grid system, thinking, well, here's someone who's resisting us. We're going to have to give them a little bit of heat from the microwaves. Anyway, that's one another dystopian way of looking at a lot of this. But listen, the singularity which these transhumanists talk about is this whole idea that the computer will actually become conscious. And do you think that's real? Is that sounds like you know, that 2001 The Space Odyssey?
It will definitely happen. And it will happen, like Elon Musk say, artificial intelligence will develop itself super speed. And what will happen is that we will not understand. We are not able to understand the output of AI. And there, that's a huge problem. You have to compare us to an AI as a sort of pet. Like Elon Musk said, we're a sort of nice cat comparing to what AI will be. So if you don't restrict it, if you don't use it in the correct way, if you don't make sure that all the check and balances are okay, we will look at a very dystopian future. And it's not in 100 or 200 years. It's probably between 50 and 80 years.
Well, 2028 is before that. But anyway, also genetic engineering is a big part of this. They're saying that they believe that they might be able to genetically engineer humans so that they will, their children anyway, will live forever.
And they're already doing it. If you know the Chinese company BGI, you have to really to check that these guys are amazing. They've done a lot of work with CRISPR-Cas9. That is a sort of part of your DNA that seems to be really easy to modify. But in China, you already can make sure that your children have a nice eye color or they don't suffer from depression, if that's a point in your family background. So we are already entering this zone.
And okay, how much do I have to pay in order for my children to live forever then?
Yeah, that's a good thing. How much do you have to pay? I don't have a clue, but I'm sure it will be a figure.
Probably the figure that only the Bilderbergers can afford it.
Yeah, and especially the Chinese, very rich, or the Saudis, or people that have loads of money and power. But I don't think it's only about money. It's also about exchanging powers and exchanging network opportunities.
Yeah, but there's another side to all of this, and that is that, you know, you can sell these things, and people can pay for them, but they may not work. You know, they may be a sort of criminal element in here saying, well, let's get their money off these people with selling them these wonderful ideas. But anyway, look, let's just go back to Turin and your experience there. I mean, you're both filming there. You're both trying to cover it as freelance journalists. How did you get on?
Yeah, well, at first we checked out the hotel when there was no security, and we could just walk around there and have a chat. But then later on, a few more days later, there was a lockdown with fences all around where the Bilderbergers were. And we also had a good look around. So, I looked at this building, which was attached to the old Fiat factory, and I said to Maria, we should be there up on the third floor. And she said, well, let's just go in and ask. And it turned out to be a polytechnic academy where we went to the desk, and we just asked if we could film on the next day when the Bilderbergers arrived to get them on film. And they said it was okay. So the next day we returned, and we got about 50 of them on film, including the one we just talked about, Jared Cohen.
So you got a kind of bird's eye view, did you?
Oh, yeah. It was great. Yeah. We really noticed there was a tight security. Nobody was able to see any Bilderbergers arriving from the public street. So no, we were very privileged to have that idea and to actually do it.
Well done. Did you manage to sell your pictures in the Dutch newspapers?
No. No. People are not interested, Tony. I even heard in Turin that our Italian friend Max, he asked some people, "Do you know what's going on in there in the Lingotto?" Because that's what it's called. And they said, "Oh, we heard that Justin Bieber is there." Yeah. So, and we saw the Turin newspaper, La Stampa, which is owned by Mr. Elkan, who also owns Fiat, who also owns the football club Juventus. He was in the newspaper, but there was just a really thin piece on Bilderberg, like talking the normal Wikipedia stuff.
Now, this conference takes place at the same time this year, anyway, as the G7. Lots and lots of press interest in that, but not much interest in Bilderberg, which is a pity, because the other side of Bilderberg is that they are often find that the people that end up at the G7 are first almost groomed and picked by the Bilderbergs. But anyway, look, Maria, how did you get on as a journalist trying to cover this? Obviously, you've got a bird's eye view, fantastic spot, but did you manage to get any of this into the press in Holland?
No, the press is completely not interested. Tony, we talked to a lot of mainstream press during the G7 in Austria. And we asked them, well, at that time, the Bilderberg meeting was very close to the G7 itself. I think it was only 20 kilometers and one day in between. And they said, well, we're not interested in it. It's just not important enough. And that was all. And yeah, it's a shame because only some Hollywood Boulevard, you know, tabloids could be interested in some pictures of our king, but no, people are not interested. The guys who were very interested in Turin, and that really made a difference, was the extraordinary amount of police over there. So you had the Carabinieri, you had the state police, you had all this plain clothes, and yeah, they were everywhere. And it was such a frightening way how they detain you every time that you are making pictures. We got two times detained, a lot of other independent journalists even more times. So you can imagine how the atmosphere was. And that in combination with no protesters at all. You know, we've seen Austria, we've seen Watford, we've seen Germany, Dresden, on all these locations, there were a lot of protesters.
Now, I mean, that's surprising, isn't it? Because Italy has just gone through an election in March this year. It's taken them a couple of months to actually finally come about, decide on a prime minister and a government. But the voters, both left-wing and right-wing, voted for Eurosceptic parties, and they've got a pro-EU prime minister now. I just wonder what you make of the I would have thought that anybody in Italy that understood about politics should have been there saying, hey guys, you know, you were part of this movement which has stopped us getting the prime minister we wanted, but you're saying no protesters at all?
None at all. It was really strange. We thought as well that there would be protesters from the left or from the right, from both sides. So that's why I asked my Italian friend, Max, how come? And he said, well, I will bring in one of the five-star movement councillors of the Council of Turin. So that was a woman he brought in. And there was also, from the five-star movement, a future European parliamentarian. So I spoke to both of them and I asked them, what is this? No protesters from the five-star movement. And they were both a bit ashamed. They had their political answer, of course, but they were a bit unsure as well. Like, what is going on? So I asked my friend Max again, and he said that he had written emails to five-star movement politicians in the Italian parliament who had made speeches against Bilderberg in the past. And he said, I got no answer. Yeah, there's a bit strange thing. There's also the mayor of Turin is also from the five-star movement, and she turned out to be sick this week. There's a bit strange things going on, but then again, on the other hand, I think they are politicians.
Well, they are, aren't they? And it was a bit cheeky, I thought, because they were talking about having a protest on the previous Saturday, a national protest against the president, because the president didn't allow them to have the government that they wanted. And then during the week, just before Bilderberg, they caved in. They said, oh, okay, well, we'll have this guy who's from the International Monetary Fund running our country instead. Look, just final question to both of you. There's been a wave, really, of countries, really starting with the Greece a few years ago, the British with Brexit, the Spanish in Catalonia, the Italians now too, an Italexit, starting to get disillusioned with the European Union, which is really the Bilderberg conferences since the 1950s have been largely to do with creating the euro currency and the European Union. So this is really a vote of no confidence in the European Union. What do you think is going to happen with the EU? Does it have a future?
Well, does it have a future? I think it's being pushed on us since World War II. So the people have never been asked. And when they've been asked, like the Dutch in, what was it, 2005, they voted against the EU. These Bilderbergers, they have an agenda that they want to push through. They don't really care about what the people think. Otherwise, they would do what the people think.
And Maria?
In the EU, I think in the Netherlands, if you see the sentiment around the EU, everybody is against it. But still, that doesn't matter. Even the parties in the Dutch parliament that are against EU, well, when it comes, you know, to it, they all in favor of it and they see new career perspectives. So probably the euro more or less chained the EU to all the countries that are involved that have the euro as currency.
Yeah, so it's too difficult to leave, to go back to the guilder, to go back to the lira and that sort of thing, or the drachma.
They can't leave anymore. And we see the situation with the Greeks. And we saw the situation with the banks right now in Italy. But still, we have all this European stimulation funds for the banking sector. And people are get really drained. They have to pay so much taxes, you know, to stay in the EU. But still, it seems that, you know, we can't shake it down. We were not able to tear this down.
And do you think the British will be allowed to leave?
I think, but the British were they had always a very other. They had a sort of, how do you may say it, a buy-opt, so they could get out again in circumstances that now did happen, and they had a special situation. And you could say it.
Well, the British always say the continent, as if they don't really belong to Europe.
Yeah, so they were special in a way. They had sort of different levels of agreement than the other European countries. But I think the Brits could make this decision, and they had their pound still in their pocket. But for all the other European countries, it will be very, very hard to leave the EU, even if all people are happy to do so.
Now, since the Bilderberg is involved in choosing our politicians, I mean, maybe not all of them, but they certainly have, with people like Angela Merkel, Tony Blair, Bill Clinton. Many of these people, they go to the Bilderberg conference and then suddenly they pop up as our prime minister or as our president. I mean, you would have thought that the mainstream press would be fascinated by this, would want to cover it, especially with a whole load of prime ministers there, something like three or four prime ministers from across Europe, and many finance ministers, some of the most powerful people in the banking world, not to mention the big oil companies, the bosses of companies like Shell and BP, these kind of people. Just final question, why don't the mainstream press cover it?
Well, I looked into this and I found some newspaper articles from 1957 in which Mr. Prince Bernhard from Holland called together the editors-in-chief from many Dutch, not only Dutch, but European newspapers. He called them in for a big conference, and in the newspaper it said that the Bilderberg is something that in the future should be a private thing and it should not be talked about in the press. So from that time on, these editors-in-chief have been following orders.
Okay. Marco and Maria, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, cheers. From We Are Change Rotterdam, that was Maria van Boekelen and Marco Verhey.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
So I'm joined by Chris Wilson again. You were with us probably a couple of months ago, Chris, talking about the permaculture project that was, I think it's fair to say, torpedoed by a rather peculiar love relationship. But anyway, you're a former carpenter and a former psychotherapist, and I suppose the last time we spoke to you, that was more really looking at your carpentry. This time, more the psychotherapy, because you went over to South America, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to Peru.
How long ago?
It was January, February this year.
Is it an easy place to get to, reasonably cheap? And how long were you there for?
It was quite cheap. We were there for about 3.5 weeks.
What is it, sort of £700-£800 return, £1,000 return?
A bit more than that. No, a little bit more than that. I mean, because you've got to take into account travel inside Peru as well.
Okay, so what part of Peru were you heading for?
We were heading for a small community about 30 miles north of the city of Iquitos, which is on one of the tributaries of the Amazon.
Okay, so that's the Amazonian part of Peru, which is more mosquito-y.
Not next to the river, it isn't, because of the particular composition of the river banks, the clay. It's not good for mosquitoes, but there were plenty of them.
So this is, the most interesting thing is you went there to try this ayahuasca therapy. So first of all, why did you want to try that?
How much time have you got? It was a combination of reasons. I've been working very hard on a training course for people to kind of cope with the mess we're getting ourselves into. Things like slowing down, meditation, relating better to nature and to each other and so on and so forth. And I had done a lot of work on this, and I was beginning to get really kind of tired with it because it's a grind. It's like any work like that. It's hard. And then I met this extraordinary Romanian friend of mine, Gina, who one day I was telling her all about all the troubles I was having, and she just looked at me and said, "My dear, I think you are trying too hard." And I thought, "You're absolutely right."
Yeah. So what led you to this ayahuasca thing?
Well, that was one of the projects she wanted to go on, but she hadn't yet been able to find anybody who wanted to do it.
Oh, right. So this is one of those things where you find someone else and you both kind of just pair up and go off to South America.
That's right, yes. We paired up and went to South America. Yeah.
Okay, so why did you think that it was an interesting thing to do before you actually turned up?
I'd read quite a lot about ayahuasca before I said, yes, let's go. And there was just a lot of interesting things about I don't want to call it a drug, medicine, really. It's a hallucinogen, but that's the least of its properties. It's where it takes you that's really important. And Mother Ayahuasca, as she's called out there, really leads you to a much more direct relationship, both with yourself and with nature. And it's a very good thing on your spiritual journey, really, at least I thought it would be.
Some people say it's dangerous.
Poof, it depends how you do it. There are some dangers associated with it. It depends who you go with. We went with an outfit called the Ayahuasca Foundation, which was very, very well run and was rooted really in the local Shipibo medicine culture. It wasn't just done by some sort of rogue gurus or something, you know, who wanted to make money out of giving Westerners a high.
Okay, well, talking of money, it's always interesting to know how much, including the airfare, how much did it all cost you and how long were you there for?
Not far short of $3,000.
Okay, so how long?
The airfare was, you were more or less right, $750, $800, something like that, all told. The 3-week retreat, as they called it, itself was about $2,500, which is slightly under 2,000 quid. The retreat was 3 weeks. We were there for a bit longer than that because we wanted to get acclimatised, you know.
And was it, this is acclimatised to the Amazon. What kind of temperature, what was the weather like there?
Well, we were there in January and February and it wasn't the hottest part of the year, but it was pretty damn hot, actually.
I would have thought Southern Hemisphere, it's going to be pretty hot.
It was quite hot, but we were lucky there was a lot of rain there as well. I mean, if it had just been hot and humid, it would have been awful, I can imagine.
Anyway, so let's get into your 3-week retreat.
Yeah.
How did it all start?
Well, we were right in the deep end to start with. We did, during the, it was 18 days that we were actually physically there and in the community. And we started the first ayahuasca ceremony was on the first day.
Oh, hang on a minute. Because, I mean, you're saying the word ceremony. I would have thought what you're doing here is you're just taking a medicine, but you shouldn't need a ceremony to do that, should you?
No, there was a complete ceremony attached to it. For the Shipibo people who do this kind of stuff, in fact, for any of the indigenous Peruvians, there's no distinction between medical and spiritual events, if you like. So everything is surrounded by ceremony.
So they're very much healing. Into their mind over matter?
Not really mind over matter as we see it, but it's more relating to the plant spirits in a medical way as well as a spiritual way all at the same time.
So is this a sort of belief system, like a pantheistic type thing, where pantheism is about where everything has got its own spirit? I mean, you'd even say a chair and a table.
Yeah, very much so. This is pre-religious in the sense that we understand religion, definitely. Yeah, it's shamanistic.
Do you have to sort of buy into this or do you sort of suspend disbelief as part of it or what? Or do you actually find yourself coming closer through taking this drug?
Yeah, a little bit of both. But I wouldn't say that the animistic stuff replaces our ideas of spirituality as we have them here. They simply knit together very well.
Okay, so what was the first, after you'd had your ceremony, well, tell us a bit about the ceremony. What did they do?
The ceremonies, there were about 10 of us on the retreat, and there were two facilitators and the actual curandero, the head honcho who was the healer who knew all about medicines.
Is that like a shaman that sort of leads you through the ceremony?
I could say the shaman, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, although he didn't appear to us like the sort of picture of shamans that we've had from books, you know. He was a very sober character.
Was he dressed up in any kind of particular
For the ceremonies, yes. He wore a great long sort of thing like a kaftan. But normally during the day he was just in shorts and, you know, and a T-shirt.
And how many people are there for this retreat?
10 people on the retreat. There was him, and there were one or two Shipibo assistants and two facilitators, one from America and one from actually Wales, a Welsh guy, Mike.
Just like I say, tell us a bit about that actual ceremony to begin with before you actually take on this.
Okay, so they start with a meditation. The room is completely dark. You start off at about 7:30 in the evening. It lasts about 4 hours. It starts in almost complete darkness, and there's a few candles around. There's a few rituals, like sort of blowing mapacho smoke around, which is the sacred tobacco. After a while, you get to drink the ayahuasca. You get to say how much of it you want. At first, of course, everyone drinks a lot of it, and then usually most of us calm down a bit.
I would have thought the other way around. You start with a little bit and see how you get on.
Well, I don't know. We were sort of psyched up for it, really.
And what is this stuff? Is it a plant material or something?
Yeah, it's a combination of two plants. One is the ayahuasca vine, which is just like it's a vine, grows up trees.
Ivy type thing.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And the other is, in our case, a plant called chikruna. And chikruna is the one that gives you the actual visions, if you have visions. Ayahuasca is a sort of vehicle. It carries it. With ayahuasca, it gives its name to the ceremony. But you don't have to use chikruna. There are other ones you can use. But
okay, so that 3 hours, was that just ceremony before you'd actually drunk the stuff?
No. You'd start drinking after about maybe 45 minutes. And then the songs would start. The curandera would start singing the songs known as Ikaros. And they're very simple songs, but they're ones that invoke the plant spirits. And, of course, it's all done in Shipibo, so you don't know what they're actually saying. But we were given sort of song sheets afterwards so we could translate.
How are you feeling at this point?
Well, in the first ceremony, I was feeling very trepidatious. I was kind of quite worried because I didn't know what the hell was going to happen. But what I found was, as we got into the songs, I was actually, as it were, seeing or being in a landscape which was formed by the song. It was extraordinary. Like, the song was making this landscape, which is rivers and mountains and all kinds of things.
Was it the same area roughly where you were staying? Or
what, the landscape? Well,
yes, this landscape you
the
saw.
Landscape, no, the landscape in my kind of vision, if you like, was very up and down, like Dorset. Where we were, and the Amazon jungle is very flat.
It's a bit like dreaming, something like that, was it?
Yes, it's very much like a sort of very vivid dream, but it's not as quick as a dream. It goes on and on and on and on, you know, as it follows the song.
Now, in the UK, probably people might associate this kind of experience with things like LSD, magic mushrooms, yeah, that sort of thing.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, we were told that ayahuasca is essentially different, but I have no idea because I've never done mushrooms or LSD because I'm scared to death of hallucinogens.
But so, yeah, there you are taking one.
Well, yes, exactly.
So what? Come on, explain yourself.
Well, because I've always associated hallucinogens with a kind of random, you know, the desire to get high, really. This is what people want from it. But for me, the ayahuasca, the essential thing about that was the ritual and the context.
So you saw this landscape. Any other visions you saw on this stuff?
Yeah, numerous ones, but they weren't always easily classifiable. I mean, sometimes it was just colours. It was like being in a grove of trees, if you like, of with extraordinary kind of reds and blues and purples and colours.
But you were actually in a dark room at the time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. But
you feel, does it make you feel good? Bad? Difficult?
Both.
Easy?
Both, because one of the things that it does is it's a purgative. So, I mean, this is the sort of horrible side of it, is that you usually get sick after about maybe half an hour. And I found this very difficult because, I mean, I would think, oh, my God, I'm going to be sick over myself. I need to be near the bucket so that I don't miss, you know. And that sort of thing was getting in the way of it because, actually, I never missed and you don't really have to worry about that. But, yeah, I mean, you hear around you the sounds of, you know, the sort of coming from all over the room. And the extraordinary thing about that is that I, you know, in my sort of vision, I was making those into animals. Like strange corkscrew-shaped animals and sort of strange beings coming up out of the floor. And that's what this noise was doing for me.
I mean, this would in Britain would be illegal, would it?
Probably. I don't know. I never found out.
Can you tell us what you think and whether you think it should be illegal or is it something that's perfectly safe to do?
I think it's perfectly safe to do if you do it, if you're in the hands of people who know what they're doing.
I suppose that's what you're saying about being scared of hallucinogenic drugs. That is to say that this was under supervision of some sort.
Yes, I've heard so many stories of bad trips. You know, I just think, I just don't want any bad trips. Now, you can get a bad trip with ayahuasca, but then you're immediately available, the curandero, and you can talk about it. And he can interpret it for you. You can say, so what was this like?
Does it bring up buried memories, things like that, do you think?
It does in some respects. Yeah, it does for some people, and in some respects it does.
And is it a very personal thing, or is it sort of a more general?
No, it's very personal.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think you got out of it?
It was quite subtle what I got out of it. I didn't get
I'm not expecting you to say, actually, nothing. you know, you spent £3,000. That's quite a lot of money to spend on nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think you've, you know, just chatting to you now, it does seem like you've got something from it.
Yeah, I did. It's hard to say exactly what it was, but for me, I've always regarded the universe in a sort of subconscious level as a hostile environment. You know, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with it, and it's against us, and we have to be very wary of it and so on. And I now have completely lost that. For me now, the universe is a totally benign environment and we are looked after, even though if you look around you and see all the violence and horrible things that are going on, it looks as if it isn't like that, but actually it is.
Now, this is a controversial one because some doctors have said that hallucinogenic drugs could be quite a good way of treating mental illness. Do you think you're in any position as someone who was a psychotherapist to have an opinion on that or not?
I would say use them with great caution. And only in the hands of somebody who really knows what they're doing. Because, you know, the random application of very strong drugs like this doesn't always lead to good results. You know, if you're psychotic and you take LSD, for example, you're likely to end up killing yourself, you know. Ayahuasca is not different in that respect. You have to respect it. It's very powerful stuff.
And would you do it again?
Yeah.
No hesitation there.
I'd like to move on to San Pedro, actually, which is the which is another sort of plant derivative, but I've yet to find where that is.
Do you think they'll ever be doing this kind of thing in Britain in a formal way, in a legal way?
I very much doubt it. There are several things against it. One of the practical things is that they're running out of ayahuasca vine because so many people are going to Peru and denuding the countryside of ayahuasca, you know?
Or they'll be cultivating it soon.
Maybe.
Anyway, Chris Wilson.
It needs a tropical forest, you know.
Chris Wilson, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect. Fascinating.
A pleasure.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. We Are Change Rotterdam, that's Maria van Berkelen and Marco Verhey. Also to Chris Wilson, you just heard, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They are online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8 p.m. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week on Dialect, goodbye for now.
Right about now, we're gonna get...